Hello everyone, and welcome to another Horrific Review. I'm joined once again by Steve as we continue our look at the Hammer Horror series of films. Released in 1957, The Abominable Snowman tells of a kindly English botanist and a gruff American scientist who lead an expedition to the Himalayas in search of the legendary Yeti. Fun times. We'll get back to black and white again.
Yeah, it's... It's like you said, it makes you wonder if they swapped them around on 1957, wouldn't it?
Yeah, because both, we've got The Curse of Frankenstein for comparison. It was released in May of 1957.
Yeah.
And this was released in August, so it was released later. Yet, Curse of Frankenstein's in Technicolor and sounds like a movie.
Yeah.
This is a black and white stage play that just happens to be on film.
Yeah, it is. That's what it looks like, and even the scenery makes it look so amateur. It looks like it was, you can tell it was filmed in the studio, really.
If you
even listen to when they're climbing over some of the rocks that are supposedly covered in snow, you can hear their feet on like plaster cast type stuff going bang bang like that.
Yeah, you kind of wonder. The problem is back then, we don't get the information. Obviously, everything was kept quiet, and there weren't the press releases, and there wasn't the making-offs or none of that kind of business. So something appeared in cinema, and that was it. That was the only chance, and maybe appeared in TV later, but you really heard nothing about the goings-on behind the scenes.
No.
Obviously, 100-odd years of cinema, we've kind of... got used to the fact that there's studio interference, there's, you know, budget concerns. There's no budget information for this. I looked, so this is almost right back to the old school sort of, you know, just come out and nothing was collected.
Yeah, and you could tell the studio scenes because it was just a grey sky in behind. There was no clouds or anything. It was just like a grey.
Yeah, it was just the backdrop, and then the change the colour to suit.
And then when it went to the actual scenes where there was real snow and they were climbing, there was sky.
I thought that was funny, actually. You know, they did the transition shots.
Yeah.
Between the stage and then obviously the stunt doubles had, you know, filming from the helicopter.
But it was exactly like a stage play, you know, because in a stage play, when they're looking at things like stars, and they just stand at the end of the stage and point up and go, look at that, look at that. And there was a couple of scenes where stood like they were on the edge of a stage going, there he is, there he is.
Look, he's absolutely. He's got it there. The only thing I felt, this felt very much like Little Shop of Horrors. In terms of a stage play.
I wouldn't
say, definitely the scenes out in the snow, the Buddhist camp was quite good.
Yeah.
We spend most of the movie, actually.
Steven the snowman.
I think they spent all their budget on the Buddhist camp and then left nothing else. And the aerial shots, that would have been expensive back in the day.
But if you think of the Buddhist temple, they just wouldn't have had them there because they're a very private sort of, you know, religious. I doubt whether they would have probably had the Peter Cushing there if he was a doctor investigating plants, but they wouldn't have had the others there who, you know, were going to go up and try and find the Yeti and cause havoc like they did and not pay the guides, you know, who were there.
Well, that was to make them, that kind of makes sense, because if they had to pay them before they came back, they would have just scuppered.
Yeah, but they just wouldn't have had those sort of people in their...
Or they would have had a lower level, like a stable or something, but not, oh, this just hang about in the middle of the, you know, during rituals and just walk through and everything else. You're like, I don't think that's how it works.
No.
But, you know, at the end of the day, that was back then. People didn't, you know any better. So you could kind of put that on screen.
Yeah.
But it was interesting, though, because we see the difference in interactions between the British and the natives and the Americans and the natives.
Oh,
that wouldn't be allowed today. We wouldn't be allowed to, we'd have to be Criterion today.
Yeah. I just find these British films and they bring these Americans in. It's like sort of one sort of thing against another, you know, where the Americans are overpowering in their speech, aren't they? And of course, you've got the likes of Peter Cushing, who's a renowned actor, and he's like, even though it's acting, he's given as good as what the American gets. And
he wiped the floor with them. You know what I mean?
They just seem to be trying to both win the Oscar, and Peter Cushing was winning.
Yeah, I think what it is, back then, there's this weird thing in the UK, especially among you lot English, because no confidence in yourselves. And there's this thing about you need permission from the Americans to exist.
Yeah.
And I never understood it. And it's especially a London-centric thing. Mm. Every Londoner thinks they're a Yank.
Yeah.
And they're even now, it's got to the point, they're sounding like them, they're writing like them, they're using the same mannerisms, using the same language. It's like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, get your own.
But it was this case of, unless an American's in it, the American audience aren't going to buy it. You know, that, why would they want watch us sort of thing? That's that lack of self-confidence I find really jarring.
Yeah.
And kind of cringeworthy.
So one of the things I noticed was the casting. I felt it was pretty iffy of Richard Wattis. You would have seen the guy with the glasses. He was...
he played the
assistant. He always used to get the same type of part in films.
Fox. He was playing Fox, yeah.
Yeah. He plays the sort of secretary type... because he's very camp, isn't he, really? He seems to get typecast in the same sort of roles. And I just thought... Yeah, perhaps it was the wrong sort of casting for this type of film. Because he appeared to be more of an equal to Peter Cushing than a sort of understudy type. If he was an understudy, a secretary or something like that, it would have worked. But because he was an equal and they were both, discussing things along the same lines, it's... I just felt he just wasn't the right character. If you look at what he's been in, you know, he is in quite a lot, but he's played the same sort of thing.
Basically a jobbing actor, you know. He has a role. He plays it well. That's it.
Yeah, he died in 1975.
Actually, funny enough, I watched a series there, One Piece.
Yeah.
When I was using up the rest of my Netflix subscription before it cancelled. And Craig Ferbras managed to play another character apart from an East London gangster.
Oh, right.
And he actually acted.
How?
No, and he was good. And it took me a bit of going, I know him. And then he's wearing this like really sort of over the top, you know, it's like based on an anime. So they're wearing like the over the top costumes and the over the top gestures. And he has this like huge, like blonde braided mustache.
Mm.
And he's playing a chef, an ex-pirate chef. And he was actually bloody brilliant in it.
He was in Cliffhanger with Sylvester Stallone, you know.
God, I try to forget that movie exists. Yeah. That's another one, a bloody Sylvester Stallone directing a movie but can't resist being a self-insert.
I know.
And he's totally the wrong build for a rock climber.
Yeah, and he was there 1 minute. They said, take your shirt off, and he had to climb up with just his vest on. He gets to the top, he's freezing cold like this, and then someone says something to him, and next minute he's, hey, I'm warm again. It's like, it couldn't have been. You've just gone through the like minus 20s, you know.
That was a silly movie.
But going back to this guy, Richard Wattis, he was in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Oh god!
Yeah, at the Sweet Factory. He was the like secretary person there in the sweet factory when they were going toot sweets. Toot, sweets, toot, like that.
I haven't seen that in years. I mean,
he was also in Confessions of a Window Cleaner, which again, Val Guest directed and wrote.
There was a cheeky series.
Yeah. Yeah. He was also in Casino Royale. So he had something with this Val Guest that Val Guest thought, I'll have Richard Wattis in these films because he appeared to be in a lot that Val Guest actually either wrote or directed.
But you find out with directors, though, they have their sort of go-to for actors.
Yeah.
And that's, you see it today as well. Tim Burton's the most obvious one. Quentin Tarantino's another. They have their sort of cast, their troupe of actors that they want to use for their movies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's, and honestly, I don't have a problem with that. You know, as long as the end product's good, fair enough.
But, as I said, the only thing I thought it was a miscast in this one, but as brilliant as an actor he is, because he seems to pull it off quite well. But there wasn't a lot. If you look at this film as a stage show, as a theatre type production, you'd get away with some of the things like when they were climbing over some of the rocks. You could tell from the noise that the boots were making on the rocks that they were some type of plaster cast or cardboard or something like that, and because they were going, instead of sort of the sliding on the snow, it was going bang.
Well, they didn't really have the Foley back then, so you know what I mean? This is like the advent of modern cinema, 20th century. This is just really not that far off from silent movies, if you think about it.
Yeah.
This is sort of the next stage from silent movies, and then only just broaching in the color. That's really early cinema, so I can look at it and can forgive a lot, because God, there's movies made today that are worse. Movies made today that are absolutely horrendous, and when you look at back then what they at least tried to put across, I can let it go. But
I mean, cinema today we know is absolutely appalling.
There's no excuse for it.
No. But I think if you look at this one from the point of view that it was 1957, I think, it means a lot more. I think it was a bit long in the sense that you only actually saw two shots of the snow. Well, one shot of the actual snowman's face, one of an arm, and that's all. I suppose you saw another one when they actually shot the one of the snowmen, didn't they?
And you sort of see the arm, a bit of an arm.
But even there, it was very theatrical because they were pointing down, saying, "Oh, look at his face," sort of thing, and you never actually saw it.
You could picture this being a radio play.
Yeah.
This could easily have been converted to a radio play.
Yeah, definitely.
This is more, not so much a straight horror as in, jump scares and that kind of thing. This is more of a thought piece. This is a moral quandary being presented. Yeah. Should we or shouldn't we? When is science gone too far? Where are our limits? Where do we stop?
Even down as far as Peter Cushing, when he says, I'm going to climb up the mountain, and his girlfriend or wife, whatever it was. His wife didn't want him to. And you could see the sort of chemistry between them. She didn't want him to, and she was pretty, mad at him for deciding to go up there. When he was up there and they thought he was under attack, etc., she was very much a concerned wife. So that sort of bit there was little side thing.
What you're saying is in 1957, they were able to create a strong female character.
Yeah. I think she played it very well. She was like, she was even down as far as nearly, look, I'm in charge, you're not doing it. And of course, you can't say that to Peter Cushing. I'm doing it, you know.
Yeah, but you had an accident, you moron, and obviously nearly broke yourself. You're not doing it again.
Just make sure you're insured. yeah, she was for 1957, she was a very strong leading.
And they even mentioned that, oh, that's not normal. They didn't say it was wrong. They was like, well, that's not normal. Your wife works with you? Like, yes, we always work together. She's a expert in her own field. Like, I'm not a bat of an eye.
No.
You know, it was just, the subject was broached. Yeah, you don't normally see this. Well, blah, blah, blah. I'm done. Yeah. There was no preaching. There was no girl bossing.
No.
There was just a character. And plus, she had flaws. She was emotional. She was worried. She was a human character. So you can empathize with her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although, do you really know how to close bloody doors?
No.
To have that stupid hatch in the thing there is freezing cold, and you know, if that was reality, every time they open a hatch, a cold breeze would go in, and every time you get heat built up, I would go ballistic.
Yeah, especially with the cost of electricity these days. Well,
I close every door.
Yeah, yeah.
I've always done that, you know, this whole idea of leaving all the doors open. I don't do it. But that would absolutely have drove me up the wall, the fact they all just barge in, or this, let's look outside, open the thing and all up. And I'm like, what the hell?
Just tell me one thing, though. Did you actually see them lift all that equipment up to the area where they caught the monkey? Where did they take the cage? Who took the cage up?
Now, remember, there was a whole... Now, I put this in the notes, so you should read. They actually explained, and this is something that they do not do in modern movies, but they actually explained in the plot that they'd been up there a year before.
Ah, right, yeah.
And they'd actually left caches, and they'd actually moved the Sherpas on, and somebody stayed behind and hid the cache so they wouldn't see it and pilfer it. And they'd spent the whole year planning for this. And they actually talked about the whole process and the fact that they broke their backs doing it. But they were ready this time.
Yeah.
There was a whole spate of dialogue. And I'm like, that is something that never happens in movies today. It would just be, like you said, it would just be there and you were left up to yourself. Oh, right, it just happened. No context whatsoever.
Yeah.
And I applauded the movie for that. I'm like, yes, finally, I better... And how long did it take? You missed it. Obviously, you know, it was just a bit of exposition, dialogue between the characters, and they explained how the whole thing came. So when you got up there, and, oh, hold on, they've got backpacks. How did they have all this equipment? It was already done the year before. They'd led a major expedition up to where they were, and they'd already scouted the area, and this was their going up to actually do it. They'd spent a year planning for this. This was a massive undertaking.
I think I remember it now.
And I'm like, no movie today would bother doing that. They'd either over-explain it and overshow it, or they wouldn't bother at all and just leave a big gaping plot hole.
The other thing I came to light, I would have hated to be with any one of those guys who was holding a rifle. You see, they were holding them and pointing them at any minute now, you know, you haven't got a safety catch on that bloody thing. You're going to shoot someone. Don't point a rifle at someone if you're not going to use it, you know. I thought in the cave, he was there with his rifle. He was waving it around and it was like, shit, he's going to shoot Peter Cushing in a minute.
Yeah, but he's actually giving Dove frowns.
But you don't realize that there, but
you're told afterwards, you're like, what the hell? But they kind of overacted a bit. There's a lot of overacting in this.
The American guy, wasn't it?
He was
what's his name? Forrest Tucker, Tom's friend. Yeah. The main protagonist, the American guy. And he was just like the one who was having a go with Peter Cushing's Dr. Rolleston. The two of them sort of together, weren't it? Trying to hit off against each other. But
you're not beating Peter Cushing. Just stop.
I just can't.
You're just not out acting.
I don't think there's any actor alive today that could beat
Peter. No, just don't. If you'd ever had a chance to be in a role with Peter Cushing, just be grateful that you shared space with him. Because that's, you know, there's no way anyone, the only one that would even come close would be Christopher Lee.
Yeah.
But those two were that, like, those two were proper friends.
Yeah.
And there was no way, they complemented each other so well, and there was no ego.
No.
They were just pure pals, and you see it on and off screen, even pictures of them later on in life visiting each other, they're always in touch.
Yeah. And you can see them both as well, sort of critiquing each other without getting upset. So if one said in a scene, you know, do you think that should go like this instead? Should we do that one again? There wouldn't be any animosity, as if to say, hey, I'm the better actor, sort of thing, and you. I'm not doing that again. You just wouldn't get it between the two because...
And that's why there's always magic on screen when you got one or both, you know.
Yeah.
You can't argue with it. You know, there's a proof in the pudding of this whole collection of movies, plus everything else they've done. But it was interesting as well. There was a bit of a... As I said, you wouldn't see us today because... British would also have to be shown to be lesser or something, but you see Peter Cushing and Fox and his wife, they're in the temple, they're being respectful and they're being given access to everything, even the point of where Peter Cushing's about to light a cigarette and he goes to the llama, may I?
Yeah.
You know, everything's done, they're in harmony, and then the Americans arrive, we are lied!
Yeah, that's right. We're here. Bang.
And everyone's like, huh?
If I was the llama, I would have said, get him out of here. Chuck him out. Chuck him down the mountain. But the when they initially said they were looking for a llama, I was looking for a llama. No, I wasn't, because I know the...
No, it's... Isn't they do that...
It's bad. Yeah. I was trying to ring him, actually, because I was dial a llama.
A German playing a llama, the llama as well, was interesting. Like, the two actors in this that spoke weren't Nepalese.
No.
But yet they had an indigenous cast.
Yeah.
I don't get it. It's like, they had the ability, maybe just because... Might have just been language barrier.
You never know, yeah. It was the casting director.
But they were prepared, you know what I mean? They were quite happy for indigenous folks. It's not like The Mummy, which we'll do at some point, where everyone's wearing tan. But they actually had indigenous folks like in the temple and supporting actors. But the two that were actually delivering lines, one was German, one was British.
Yeah,
guy played the guide as well. He was British.
It was only actually according to they actually got someone just to do the Yeti eyes in the cast. They got two Yetis and one guy who'd just done the eyes. So that's obviously funny. The two Yetis didn't have. Oh, the three Yetis.
There was three in the final shot.
Didn't have bad eyes. cracking.
I think that was a wee bit of an extravagance.
Yeah. Oh, we got a spare 100 quid. Let's get a bloke in to do the eyes.
Fox's character, that whole scene where he's doing everything to avoid drinking the tea was hilarious. That was a proper comedic moment.
Yeah. I'm just trying to...
And you kind of see the interplay because the llama kind of knows he's being polite and trying to avoid it, and he's just egging him on just for fun.
Yeah.
Oh, it'll get cold. It's okay. Yeah. It'll get cold, you know.
I'm surprised at this, though, that in the advertising, in the marketing of it, Peter Cushing wasn't actually the first person on the thing. It was this Forrest Tucker who was so it would have gone Forrest Tucker, Peter Cushing on the poster. I found that strange, really.
It's back to this strange culture, London-centric culture. It's been around for so long, and we're seeing the effects of it now. Like, we're being, you know, don't want to get political and stuff, but culture matters, and you see this kind of strange self-loathing thing that's going on, and there's really no need for it.
Yeah.
And then that's what eventually leads to the anger and resentment, and then acting out in all the wrong ways. You know, it's, you can't keep grinding people down and chipping away at them.
You can just imagine it. Peter Cushing probably didn't give a damn.
He doesn't seem to be the type. Like, somebody, like,
if you know, today, you know,
the only ego back in the day of that sort of era was Vincent Price.
Yeah.
Isn't even on the same league.
If you'd done it like someone like Tom Cruise, I suppose, he would have had a baby over this. I can't put my name second.
I do. The day I lost any interest whatsoever with Tom Cruise was The Last Samurai.
Yeah, I didn't see it.
I only watched it because Billy Connolly was in it. I saw the trailer. I saw Billy Connolly was in it. I'm like, you'll do me. This is a Billy Connolly movie with Tom Cruise. Mm. And of course, Billy Connolly's out acting Tom Cruise at every instance. So, yeah. You'd say Billy Connolly's character didn't last too long. And of course, Tom Cruise had to be last man standing sort of thing. And you're just like, you idiot. You know.
I just find, let's not go into Tom Cruise. The last film I watched of Tom Cruise, I think, was The Firm. And I only watched it because it was a John Grisham novel that it was based on, because I do like reading John Grisham.
Yeah. He was the Pelican Brief, wasn't it?
Yeah, he did that one. John,
never seen the movie of that. I've heard of it, but I read the book, obviously. I've read a couple of his books.
Quite a hard read, John Grisham novels, and sometimes you've got to read it twice to pick up on it, but the other thing I thought was funny was what they actually climbed the mountain in all the snow in seemed to be like a cagoule, really, because it's quite ironic that last night the film that we watched on television, the three of us, because my son's up with me, was Everest,
mm-hmm.
About the true story about the adventure company that went up to climb Everest, and several of them died. And they were wearing all this like protective gear, you know, really thick stuff. I even laughed at one of them because he was just wearing a North Face jacket, like the one I've got, Jake Gyllenhaal, that was. And then you got these guys who were climbing the mountain in the Himalayas, and the snow and the wind was coming out, and there was, you know, where the snow falls down. I forgot the word.
Avalanche.
Avalanche, that's the word.
Don't shout or you'll cause an avalanche.
Yeah.
friend.
Stop firing the gun.
We have to speak quietly. You're like.
But they had this, like, I mean, it wasn't, the suits they were wearing weren't any thicker than some of the sort of hoodies that I've got, you know, and I thought, are they going to survive up there?
People proper did that back in the day.
Yeah.
If you look at climbing gear, what do you call that? The Hovsky Pass or something? What's that one? You know, the Atola Pass?
Oh, yeah.
The one with the Russian expeditioners, and they all got wiped out in a really strange and gruesome way. If you look at you can find loads of pictures, and they're not pretty, but see the equipment they're wearing isn't much better. And that was the 60s.
Yeah. I mean, they obviously did it, you know, in real life back then. But
if you think as well, it wasn't until like the 90s. The Gore-Tex, you know, Gore-Tex was the game changer. And breathable fabrics and layers.
You didn't hear of as many people dying back then, did you? Of, you know, of cold and frostbite and stuff like that. But,
just every major expedition that ever tried to do either the Arctic or the Himalayas tended not to, you know, survive.
Yeah.
They just tended not to do it. It was a rare occasion. I think the problem today is everyone thinks they can have a go.
Yeah.
Everyone thinks you can gear up, get a few crampons and carabiners, and just, you can be a rock climber. You can go down to the local leisure centre, do a few sessions on the wall, and that somehow equates to you climbing up the side of a mountain.
Yeah. I wouldn't even attempt it, to be quite honest.
Well, I was ML trained. I used to take groups up the hills and all back in the day. I wasn't always this. I didn't always have 20 chins and this flabby, jelly-like physique. I actually used to be quite fit, funnily enough. And I used to do crazy stuff like that. And then, it's not.
I actually worked for the Devon Schools instructor in rock climbing. We used to take the schools out down Dewarstone in down Shaw Prior there. So I used to do quite a bit of rock climbing, but I used to do caving as well down in Devon, which. It's quite scary. I mean, like you, I was a lot thinner then. I was a size 30 waist. But, it's, you know, we used to say it's all about breathing. You can get through a little gap if you don't panic and you breathe well. And
head and shoulders.
The places, yeah.
I remember even being taught at school. So my PE teacher got me into those for the Duke of Embers Award. But we, you know, the old benches?
Yeah.
We used to crawl through them, and he always used to say, Mr. Officer, that if you can get your head and shoulders through, the rest you'll follow.
Yeah.
And we used to, like, it wouldn't be allowed today, you know what I mean? Stuff would not be allowed today. It would be considered abuse.
Yeah.
If we raked about, we would go down an outdoor education center, right? And if we stayed up and made too much noise, he would have had us tramping around the hills, and then he'd be waiting in the minibus, and we'd have got down, he just drove off. And we'd have had to have, you know, chase him. He's like, are you going to sleep tonight, boys? Yes, sir. You know what I mean? That's the way I was taught. And there were valuable life lessons.
Yeah. So you said, you just, in Everest, you know, you've got three different parties going up this mountain led by an adventure group. Well, you know, it's silly stuff, really, thinking that you can just, I'll go on an adventure tour and I'll climb up that mountain, Everest, that, you know, it took Sherman Hillary, wasn't it? It took him years of training to do, and I'm just going to go up and do it now. I just don't see the point of it. But,
It's that whole thing, though, you know, testing yourself. People are like, why would you do that? You know, and it's the whole point of testing yourself, and there's nothing more unforgiving than nature. Nature does not care about you.
No. Well, there's back in 2009, before I became really ill, I had a bad time in 2009, and I was hospitalized and everything. But I was planning with a couple of friends to actually go into the crater of a volcano over just off the coast of Australia, and it was Antrim Island, it was called, and you land in Australia on the jet, and then you take one of these aeroplanes where you have to start the propellers yourself over and onto Antrim Island. And the gist of it was you trekked through the jungle, you stayed with the tribe there, ate their food, and then you went up to the volcano, you went had a look around the volcano, came back down, stayed with the tribe again, and then trekked back through the jungle, and then caught the plane back to mainland Australia. We were all for this, and then I was taken seriously ill, so I didn't get to do it. Yeah, it's that I would find different, because it was, yes, there was a climb up to the crater because it was a caldera of the volcano, but it wasn't as bad as going up Mount Everest. Yeah,
but the fact that somebody would go to Everest, that's the first thing they do, is go to Everest first.
Yeah, you just wouldn't do it, would you?
No, it's maybe have a go at Ben Nevis first, or Snowdonia, or Scafell Pike, or even Slieve Donard, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Start off with one of those, and then see how you get on with full kit.
Yeah.
Because most people do those sort of treks, or a little backpack. No, load yourself up with what you need, and see how far you're getting.
Yeah,
and then you soon find out.
Going back
in the winter, don't do it in the summer.
Going back to
winter when the rains come on.
A lot of the sort of monasteries high in the mountains, on some of the biggest mountains out. And when you consider this was in the Himalayas, you know, it must have been somewhere. What's the name of the mountain in the Himalayas? There's a big mountain over there, isn't it?
It's not K2.
Kilimanjaro, is it?
No, Kilimanjaro's Kenya, I think.
Yeah. There's a big mountain in there in the Himalayas.
Is it not K2?
Is it K2?
Everest is in Nepal. It's on the thing. Kanchenjunga. Kanchenjunga is the next one. Yeah, that's K2.
K2, is it?
Yeah, Kanchenjunga is K2.
So
that's next to the Everest. That's, you know, it's Everest and K2 are the ones.
Yeah. I just thought in the Himalayas there was a big mountain that they climbed.
But they have a whole network of camps and buildings, and that wasn't entirely untrue when they say about, you know, the huts and stuff they had there, the caches, that was all built. These are the people, that's how they traded between Nepal and India and where else is it? It's an interesting region because there's, you know, it shouldn't have human life, and yet it's got one of the most vibrant trading communities. Sure, Hannibal was able to get Alphons over it, you know what I mean? How good the roads and stuff were. Put your local council to shame, just say. That's who we need to hire. We need to actually get Nepalese advisors to sort our roads out, because our university educated engineers are shit.
Well, if you think back in the 70s when they wanted to resurface a road, they used to take up the old road first. And then resurface it. And these days, all they do is tar over it. Tar over the old one.
Did you see that picture? It was only a couple of weeks ago, where they dug under all the potholes and they found an old Roman road that was still perfectly preserved.
Yeah. It's mad, isn't it? But even painting and decorating, I mean, my dad was a painter and decorator, and he taught me, you got to, you know, sand it down, you prime it, you put undercoat on. And these days, all they do is, I've seen them do it, all these council and housing association workers, they just get a paintbrush. I mean, they don't even do an apprenticeship. They just advertise off, you know, in the local job centres, don't they, for
painters. Yeah, just have a crack.
And you know, they get it and it's all running down. And
gives a toss.
They don't. And
we had a thing back home. It was called the ACE scheme.
Yeah.
And it was for painters and decorators, and what they did was, obviously, they learned their trade, but what they would do is they would go around pensioners' homes and do their, rather than wasting time in a college, or, you know, just repapering over and wasting. I don't know what the exact, you know, well, they bought some paint or something, but they would go and they would decorate a pensioner's front room for free as part of the scheme.
Yeah.
And they were getting hands-on experience, and then they were giving something back to the community as well, because, you know, back when we used to give a shit about people, our neighbours and our friends, you know, they would look after them in that respect. But, you know, all about having a bit of dignity, isn't it? You know, in your home and everything else. And
I don't know.
There was more goodwill, a good feeling, and a bit more community pride than there is now.
You still get that in my village.
Shut up or I'm moving. Honestly, you're going to end up with a neighbour you keep talking about, because my head's done in living here in London. It's freaking...
It's like the local church. They advertise for someone. Is there anyone? They've got something called gifting here, where if someone needs something, they put an advert on the Garrow Hub on Facebook saying, is anyone gifting a, I don't know, mattress or something like that? Someone would gift them a mattress, you know, an old mattress. And it's like a lot of stuff when I moved in with Cole, you know, I put it on the Garrow Hub saying free of charge, whoever wants it. And some guy come and pick something up the other day, and he says, oh, yeah, he says, my son's just like going through a divorce and he's had to restart again. He says, we're nothing. He says, so he says, we're getting everything, you know.
Beaner, that's fun.
You know, and that's what happens here. And it's like the local church advertises. Is there anyone around that could come and cut the grass in the church gardens, you know? And, you know, half a dozen people turned up.
I would, but it's the bursting in the flames. But when I step on the ground, it's just a bit inconvenient. It scares people. People don't like that, and I don't like it either. It hurts. It's like,
the gone are the old days, especially in the cities. I mean, you're in London, you know what it's like. No bugger speaks to anyone up there, do they? But,
well, I'm lucky. I'm just outside, and I'm lucky where I live. People pass themselves, so you say hello and that.
Yeah.
But even then, I just keep myself to it. You don't want to make eye contact with people. You don't know who the frig's going to launch on you.
No.
It's not even the fact I'm afraid. It's just I'm afraid of what I'll do back. And I don't need that hassle.
I actually asked the traffic warden directions. This was years and years. God, it must have been late 80s, early 90s. And I was over in near all the hospitals just the other side of Chelsea. And I was lost. And I actually said to a traffic warden, can you tell me where National Heart Hospital, I think it was, is? She went, nope. And she just walked off. Just, nope, gone. I thought, oh, there's no like, oh, no, I'm so sorry. Oh, let me think. I know. Let's ask this person sort of thing like we would have done. Nope. It's just walked off. And that was my first impression of asking directions in London. And,
I genuinely despise it here. It's shit.
Yeah.
It's all right. I've got plans. And I'll don't intend to be here for much longer because it's driving me up a wall. But anyway.
Snowman.
Yeah, there's just not much to talk about in this movie because it's not really very, it's not a very complex plot.
No.
They spend most of the time at the temple just going over the should we or shouldn't we sort of thing.
Yeah. And I thought it could have been even brought down again. Time-wise, because what was it? It was released in, I think it was, I read it was 3 minutes longer in America. It's 1 hour 25 minutes in Britain, 1 hour 31 in America. So They added 6 minutes somewhere.
I think we cut the final scene out in the American version.
No, the American version was...
Oh, then they've cut the final scene out in the British version where they have the conversation at the end, because in the British version, it's you get to the scene in the cave.
Yeah.
And the bit with the eyes, and then it cuts, goes to the credits. Where if you watch the longer version, then you get the conversation at the end. Maybe no, but New Zealand became a scary place there for a while, especially under Jacinda Ardern. She was a lunatic.
Is Chris on something tonight?
Yeah. I saw a picture, actually. The sheep have taken over. They've left that up, and the sheep have just moved in. That old set. Because it was all built on the side of hills, so they just left it. I thought they made it into a tourist attraction. New Zealand went proper scary there for a while, you know.
They actually reminded me of the Teletubbies home.
Yeah,
so does Chris want to move over there to be a Teletubby? Teletubbies. James, sorry, Chris.
There's another wee side plot as well when we're talking about Ed Shelley's character. And the fact that you can see comparisons between, this is the advent of the television.
Yeah.
Sorry, I knew I was coming.
What did you say?
I knew I was just waiting for it. Obviously, the internet lag was waiting for the response.
Yeah, Chris, this film here was an all-female cast because there was no men. Work that one out.
Oh, dear. Yeah, this is a topical point of televisions being in the home for the first time as opposed to just being on cinema. And Ed Shelley had already been rumbled for the Wolf People scam that he had found some people and pretended they were wolf children.
And
we can actually draw parallels between him and what he was prepared to do to be famous and to validate himself, and today's influencers.
Yeah.
No way every idiot can get a microphone and the camera and just go up off and talk a lot of crap online.
Yeah. And then they can get sponsored, don't they?
But when you look at the fakery that they do and some of the gnarly stuff just to be famous, and you see what he was prepared to do, it's funny how things cycle and human behavior doesn't change.
I was on about this fakery of videos on YouTube and Facebook today with my son, because I got this thing about the monkeys in Cambodia and the trade, where they trade them as pets. They go in the jungle, capture all the babies, take them to the local markets and sell them to people as pets. And these people, they dress them up in all clothes, make them walk on two legs as opposed to the four that they used to. And they film them for YouTube and Facebook videos and TikTok and whatever. But when the hits start going down, they take these monkeys and they dump them back in the jungle. Well, of course, after being living with humans since they were very small babies, they've got no skills to live in the jungle. And same thing. It's all this influence in internet thing, because they obviously get paid if they get 20,000 hits, but you know, for this monkey, etc.
There's a book I need to pick up.
I've got it
saved, a YouTube video where somebody's talking about it. Every time humanity has had a new form of communication, it's always led to this. If you go right back to the printing press, there's always been this mania. Oh, we can talk about anything, and everyone loses their mind for a bit, and then people try and stamp them down, and this, you know, it goes like that. It happened with the radio as well. It happened with television.
Yeah.
It happened with the internet, and now it's happening with social media. Because they're two different. The internet era and the social media era are different.
Hmm.
But the same mania, you know, it's just reignited at something about humanity of, I can say anything, I can talk to anybody, makes us go right back to our base of basis, the conditions.
Yeah.
And then we have to spend a decade or so getting out of that to understand what the technology is and make it part of our lives and move on. And then something else will appear and we go right back to chimps and suits. It's, yeah, it's a pattern that repeats itself over and over.
Mm. Yeah.
And nobody ever learns from it, and nobody goes, oh, we're going through this again. Right. Oh, this is brand new. This has never been done before, except for the 100 other times it's been done.
Yeah.
But it's just funny that a film in 1957 can draw direct parallels with today.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. It's... They're, yeah. It's, I think... In this day and age of things like social media, though, you know, things can get hyped up. And the latest hype, of course, is this new film that's out soon, end of this month, I think it is, called Civil War.
I was just watching a review of that before we started. It's bland nothingness, apparently.
Yeah, it's... but you think, how did they hype up something like a 1957 film, because they never had computers, it would have been done perhaps on the black and white televisions, but then not everyone had a television. So it would have had to have been posters.
Newspaper, word of mouth.
And, you know, if you think films back then made quite a lot of money. We've seen that with like the Curse of Frankenstein, wasn't it?
Yep.
And so for that to happen, people would have had to go to the cinema. But how did they know that this film was on at the cinema? I know there were a lot more cinemas because, again, we were talking about this the other day about cinemas in Plymouth. And I was saying now there used to be like... about 8 cinemas in Plymouth, even more, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got cut down to in the sort of late 80s when multi-screen complexes started to come in. It was just cut down to the 3, the ABC, the Drake, and the Odeon. And then the Odeon went under, so there was 2. And then a few cinemas opened up in the late 90s. Just in 1957, the equivalent of social media to publicise a film must have been a poster in newspapers. Mm. And therefore, word of mouth happened in the same way that it does with social media influencing today. You know, I would have said to you in 1957, oh, you know, I went to the theatre last night to see... The Abominable Snowman, and you would have said, oh, is it good? Yeah, brilliant, you know. And you would have said, I'll go and see that. And you
believe it, that still happens today.
Yeah.
People think that word of mouth does not happen because of social media, where social media is a version of reality, but it's not every day people going about and talking to each other.
Yeah.
And yes, we're a bit more... It's funny, we're more connected digitally, but less connected personally. It's an interesting phenomenon.
People don't talk
anymore because they're so frightened of saying or doing the wrong thing or starting something that it's... We don't live in good times. Like, we are... it's not good. But just on what you're talking about, I think I brought this up before, but do you remember The Tingler, 1959?
Yeah.
Well, what they had done in terms of gimmicks and hype, there were electrical buzzers on the underside of some seats.
Mm.
And you wouldn't be able to do that now.
No.
But also, people were told to have offered $1,000 life insurance policy against death by fright. The last time this sort of hype, if you remember, funny enough, because they're going to remake it, because that's what we need, but when the Blair Witch Project came out.
Blair Witch, yeah.
Yeah, there was a sort of last time there was a major hype and buzz about a movie in cinema. Word of mouth. Because after that, it kind of, and I think it was the reveal, which obviously if you're, if you've got two brain cells, you know it wasn't real. But people genuinely bought into it. But you want, you know, it's like people that want to be hypnotized, people that want to be fooled by the magician, people want to be fooled.
I was telling people, if it was real, would you really still film it while you were running away? I'd just go for it, you know. And
camera beat. Yoink.
They were going back to the same place where any sensible person would have gone, ah, there's a small stream there. It goes somewhere. I'll follow the stream down, you know. But no, not these.
What, you mean like idiots that go and try and climb Everest for the first time and never been out in the woods before?
But yeah, people actually, I remember, people were saying to me, have you seen the Blair Witch yet? Oh, it's scary. It's real, you know. And you were going,
no. Oh, don't forget as well, radio back in the day here. That would have been, people forget how big radio was.
Yeah.
And radio, you know, because I used to do a lot of recreation of radio broadcasts like Midnight Mansion and so forth. Loved doing that. Shadow People, my first ever production. I reproduced the Shadow People, got some folks on board. Listen to it now, it's absolutely horrendous because I was only like brand new learning this stuff, but it was so much fun to do. Radio, this stuff would have been on radio ads, would have been all over the place, and that's how people got the word too.
But the
last example that would have been the Blair Witch Project, where people were genuinely hyped and invested.
It would have been, because let's look at the taglines. Where did I see it? The tagline, it was here just now. But you could just see it. It was the most scary animal, you know, or they're up on the mountain alone. The Abominable Snowman, you know.
Based on actual events, you know.
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
What's a freaking tagline?
But also, we're kind of blasé.
Yeah. So the taglines were, we dare you to see it alone. Each chilling moment, a shock test for your scare endurance. Demon prowler of mountain shadows. Dreaded man-beast of Tibet. The terror of all that is human. The super beast unleashes new worlds of terror. See it with someone brave. A timeless terror to freeze you to your seats. Demon prowler of the mountain shadows. Dreaded man-beast of Tibet. The terror of all that is human. So that was the taglines for...
What do we get today? Watch this movie or else you're a bigot.
Yeah.
Bigot. Yeah, sold me.
if you're in a Liam Neeson film, they killed his wife. They killed his children. Now he's getting revenge.
It's like every movie he ever does.
Yeah.
Oh, what a tip. Friggin' culture. There was a bit of a red herring in this as well when the llama was in a trance.
Yeah.
That was such an odd scene.
Yeah.
And had no real bearing on anything.
No. There were a couple, actually, because why did that guy who had the bad fur go up the mountain? And how the hell with the bad fur did he go?
I think they were trying to hint at telepathy.
Right.
Because I think with the scene with the llama, they're trying to say that he was in contact with them. Funny enough, that character's name's Tom Friend. Because I was wondering what the hell Cushion was running about going, friend! As if he had only met him, you know, and didn't talk to him or nurse him back the head, didn't know his name. But yeah, the character's name's actually Tom Friend.
Yeah.
They should have revised that one. because that was odd.
Yeah. And the other thing was when Forrest Tucker, Tom Friend, actually decided that he was hearing voices, wasn't it? And he could hear Ed Shelley's voice, who was dead. But that sort of scene came in, but then nothing else happened on that. They didn't sort of widen the thing that they were all hearing voices. It was just him, and then suddenly that was it. It ended. No one else was hearing voices.
They did it in the cave with Cushing and or Shelley and Rawlinson. Yeah. Rawlinson thought he heard the radio, even though the radio was smashed to bits.
Yeah.
And then Shelley thought he heard Friend, you know,
yeah.
And ran out. So they did play it a bit. It just... The problem was, all that bit was rushed. To me, all the actual searching and the adventure part was rushed. And they spent so long in the temple.
Yeah.
Like, three different acts of the temple. You know, I mean, most of this took place in the temple, without even leaving. Yeah. When you think even his wife and her setting up the expedition and dealing with the other guides.
Yeah.
There's more time spent there. And then when they actually were up, even on the stage, they built the stage, so why not use it?
Yeah.
And it just seemed like they were just rushing through that bit to get through it as quickly as possible.
Yeah. And then Peter Cushing goes out and one of the guys says to him, "What have you found?" "I found some moss." "Oh, is it?" "Well, it's food." Could be food, wouldn't it? But nothing more was said about that. He just found some moss.
I think they were linking back to the fact that he was a botanist and he'd been studying the whole region.
Yeah.
And he's basically trying to explain how they would survive
up
there, and that the fact that that would provide nutrition. So they've been living off the moss and, as I mentioned, sort of there's species of rabbits. I really don't know about the monkey.
No,
I can't say whether the monkey was true or not. I don't know that much about it. It would seem a bit strange. Like, I can understand 7 foot tall, like almost the coverings of a woolly mammoth. I could picture that, but one of those monkeys, I wouldn't see surviving.
Yeah, but they actually thought it was a yeti, didn't they?
Well, if you think back in the day, you think of the early voyages. What do people think mermaids were?
Well, yeah, fish.
Well, they thought they were sea lions.
Yeah.
They saw sea lions in the distance. That's where the legend of the mermaid came from. That's what I'm saying about it. It's so easy to be blasé in the 21st century.
The size of a fully grown macaque, really, wouldn't he? You know, so anyone with a bit of sense would have thought that's not a yeti, that's a monkey. And he's not even covered in snow, sort of thing.
Well, we'll talk about the monkey hangers.
Yeah.
You know, it's sacre bleu.
Yeah.
The French are invading.
Yeah. It's the French. They're revolting. I know they're revolting. I can smell them from here. what was his name? Not Ofgar, innit? Part of the same crew as Peter Sellers and Ari Seacom.
I remember his Sunday show.
Oh, I forgot his bloody name. But yeah, they'd be funny with what they used to come out with. I think they were called the Crazy Gang, something like that.
God, that was a blast from the past, Flopsy.
Yeah, that was the people who said that. It's the French. They're revolting. I know they're revolting. I can smell them.
And apologies to Hartley Poole, by the way. I know he's got a lot of stick, but you did it. So suck it up.
So, yeah.
So you can understand, you know, I mean, it's like I said, it's easy first quarter of the 21st century, and we're like, oh, those peasants, oh, those Neanderthals, oh, they thought that, but it's entirely possible. Look at the crap that was on TV that we used to believe in the 80s.
Yeah.
It was pumped out, and now you look back and you go, really? Was I sucked in by that?
I still am in some cases.
look at the thing is, we are in such a state now of not apathy, but just disbelief. Anything's put in front of us, we question.
Yeah.
Like April Fool's isn't even worth it anymore because there's that much mad shit going on in real life that it's so impossible now to pull off a good April Fool's joke because everyone just goes, yeah, whatever, you know, aye, right, sure you are.
I actually had someone on the Garu Hub. I put a photo of a lion and his lioness laying down in the long grass. And I put it on the Garu Hub saying, warning to all dog walkers, I saw these on the other side of the mountain today. Right? And someone actually put in the comments, I don't know if they were joking or what. Oh, which part of the mountain? So I put it up near the flag because there's a flag up on top of the mountain as a tribute to one of the guys who died in Afghanistan. A young guy, he was 22, I think, something like that. And so there's a flag and a tribute bench. I said, yeah, up near the flag. I thought, are they being serious or are they just playing along with a joke sort of thing? But you never know. Yeah.
Well, do you know something even more hilarious? In the 70s, Belfast, Cave Hill, that was entirely possible because people had this thing of keeping tigers and lions in the frigging back gardens as pets. Yeah. And don't ask me how it became a thing, but it was. People legit had a frigging pet all up around that mountain houses. They all had like a pet tiger or a pet frigging something. And every so often one would get out. And that was a thing in the 70s of Belfast.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard something about that.
That was true. Honestly, people did it. I was like,
why would you keep a lion?
And the zoo's at the top of Cave Hill, so there's actually a zoo up there. But people had their own, like, mini friggin'. I don't know how that worked out, but friggin'.
That's what Sparkwell Wildlife Park, they call it Dartmoor Zoo now. But they used to have, like, all lions, tigers, and everything like that. But all they used to have to keep them in was, like, one of those wire mesh fences. Back, you know, and we used to go and visit these bloody things. Schools would go round, and all it was a wire mesh fence that would between you and them.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you think they wouldn't get away with that now? Well, they don't.
Well, we had Causeway Safari Park, and they closed that down because it was just too dangerous.
Well, do you remember that Matt Damon film? We Bought a Zoo.
If I can avoid watching Matt Damon, I will.
The guy who bought the guy who bought Sparkwell Wildlife Park and renamed it Dartmoor Zoo, wrote a book called "We Bought a Zoo." Him and his wife bought a zoo, and Matt Damon and that picked up on it and thought, "Oh, we'll turn it into a film." But they made it American. They didn't base it in Dartmoor Zoo. They made it like American, that these Americans bought a zoo. But it was based on the book. So Dartmoor Zoo, it helped them survive because they were getting all the sort of share of the royalties of this film. So
I suppose fair enough if you're happy enough. Set it wherever you want if you're getting the money for it and you know what the story is. But it's funny. Like I said, we can't really look our noses down at this and go, oh, how would people believe that? Look at the shit people believe today and look at what's going around. It's always going to be a case.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's been stories of Yetis for absolutely years, hasn't there?
Mm-hmm.
And they've done it so many. Do you remember the $6 million man? There was a story. There was a storyline with him and the Abominable
Snowman. Oh yes, that was one of his biggest episodes.
Yeah,
wasn't it the $6 million man versus the Abominable Snowman or something? Yeah. Or the, no, it was a Bigfoot. Wasn't that Bigfoot?
Was it Bigfoot?
It was Bigfoot. The American Yeti, basically.
Yeah. But
that was Bigfoot. It wasn't the Bottomless One.
Yeah, it was Bigfoot. Yeah.
After Bigfoot and Henderson's come out, like, that was it. I couldn't can't think of it any other way. Oh, that costume is done so well. Look, the animatronics not.
Yeah. Look at this. It didn't really need a lot of money in special effects. You know, there was an arm, which was just a hairy arm that you could probably get down the joke shop or something. And I got a couple of guys in face masks were, you know, just like plastic, really, wasn't it?
Used the lighting and the camera. In fact, this is one that would get, if they did a 4K version of this, it would be ruined. Like Suspiria. They used the shadow, they used the lighting, they used the cave to hide it until the reveal at the very end. If they did this in 4K, all that would be stripped and it would look horrendous.
Well, I think the best bit about this, if you can accept it, if you're not expecting the full-blown horror of, you know, this bonobo snowman pulling arms off or eating something, you know, eating someone, then it's the actual suspense more than anything, horror suspense.
Mm-hmm.
You're left thinking, oh, what's going to happen? What does that? You see the arm there, so what does the snowman really look like? And so you're left in suspense all the time. And I think that's, if you can accept that as a film, it's good for its time.
I'll give another example. 1979, Alien did exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
You never saw the xenomorph. It was only until Aliens that you properly saw the xenomorph.
Yeah.
Everything was hidden in shadow and behind bulkheads and chains, and you never really saw the full creature, even at the very end. Like, it's still done a lot of, it's not like a full, it's one of those blink and you'll miss it. Like, obviously now we can go back and pause, but if you think when that came out in the cinema, and it was only broadcast on TV, even before home rentals, you couldn't even pause the VHS.
No.
But that
made it. We're gone. Like that, wasn't it?
Yeah. But this.
Yes, yeah.
Yep. But you know what I'm saying? There is an example of using exactly the same techniques as this movie.
Yeah.
And achieving exactly the same result, just for a different time period.
Yeah.
And that's where modern movies need to take note.
I think the most they would have spent out was on the fake snow.
I would say the location shots would have been quite expensive.
Yeah.
Like, those were proper.
Or were they
location shots?
Yeah, but, or were they sort of old film? You know, were they actually location shots done specifically for the film, or were they just old?
Oh, you mean like the old Pathé stuff?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I have a funny feeling with this one. This is where the attempts, I think this is the beginning of modern cinema.
Yeah,
where a director would have went, no, I want shots. This is how I wanted to look.
On the credits, it didn't actually give credit for anywhere apart from filmed at Bray Studios. Whether they didn't have to put the location of the sort of, you know, the mountain, or let's see where it's. I don't think it's got it here. Filming location.
They would have had to have given credit if they used if they used footage reels.
The Pyrenees in France.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. So, there was a location.
Mm-hmm.
Studio was Bray Studios. Additional studio filming, Pinewood Studios. So, So filmed in the Pyrenees in France. So.
Yeah. So there you go. That would have probably been expensive.
Yeah.
Get out, set out the location shots.
Yeah, getting people to walk up the snow, etc.
Yep. Plus keeping it, like, if you saw the pristine, because it did that very well, the pristine snow where nobody had trekked.
Yeah.
So if you think they had to get that shot right once.
Yeah.
Or else that was it ruined.
Yeah. Because even if you scrape it over, you can see that it's been done.
Yeah. So you think of that, would have to, you know, those scenes with them tracking through, if that wasn't done right, then they'd have to move to an entirely new valley to start again.
Yeah, definitely.
And this is the problem that we don't have. This is where Home Movie really created an archive for cinema because of home DVD sales. So therefore, it became commercially viable for the special features.
Yeah.
So what you effectively have is a living documentary of film history.
Yeah.
Which we don't have now. Like, they can... I don't know why they don't use social media like YouTube or something, you know, monetize that way, or a website. Like, Peter Jackson did it for King Kong.
But people whereas they give a film, the actual film, I don't know, stars out of five, they actually give the making of and things like this, you know, the extras on
just as much effort.
3 out of 5 and 4 out of 5 and, you know.
Especially in the horror genre. The making of is actually at times more compelling than the movie itself.
Yeah.
Especially if it's a visual, you know, visually stunning or has a particular aesthetic. Delving into the background of how that came to be. It's fascinating. The last one that really blew me away was the Lord of the Rings trilogy, you know, watching the special features and that, and how they brought that world to life.
I'm one of these who didn't like the Lord of the Rings.
And that's fair enough. But at the same time, you have to respect.
From a cinematic
point
of view, it was stunning.
But this is where you might get something from the special features as opposed to the movie.
Yeah.
Do you know where I'm coming from? Where the special features can actually be more compelling. If you didn't quite fancy the movie, but at the same time you're like, oh, there's a lot of effort went there, and then you go into the backstory of how something was made. I'll give an example, actually. When it did King Kong, I was kind of meh. You know, it wasn't really... I thought it was very long when I first watched it, but then I watched the special features later on for the review. Dale, and when I saw the amount of effort that went into it, I had a new appreciation for the movie. And I think back then they didn't have that, which is a shame, because there's history lost. How they did this, how they brought stuff together. And there's something that up-and-coming filmmakers today could go right back to basics. Think of the indie film industry. There's techniques, there's way to use basic cameras. You know, we've obviously got more advanced cameras today, but there's the techniques of using the basic stuff that has essentially been lost. That could be of benefit to filmmakers today. Because everything now has been made huge, massive budget. So all you're seeing is these huge, purpose-built warehouses of a permanent sound set, which is out of reach of somebody that's just making a movie, where if we had a record of the making of these sort of movies, that would be a goldmine for filmmakers today who are wanting to be independent of Hollywood, who are wanting to make their own stuff, but they don't know, they don't have a multi-million budget. And they're not learning how to make movies using what they're using or getting the vision of the directors. Like all those hammers, like, you think of like Curse of Frankenstein, all that. I'd love to get a peek behind the wall. The Amicus series, I'd like to get a peek behind the wall, how they did a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, that's, you know, it's one of those things we can only imagine. And we can only hear third hand from scholars, you know, who are not the most reliable people because they always have a slant. They weren't there. So you always get best information from the horse's mouth, whoever was actually there creating the thing. That will always be the best source of information. And it's an era that, because they didn't have the it was hard enough to create a movie on film, but there was no commercial viability to create the special features.
Because there was no such thing as VHS back in this day and age. It would, if they wanted to see it, they would have had to see it in the cinema with the film. And back then, you already had two movies, didn't you? You had the feature and the main feature, with the ice cream lady in the middle, or you had Flash Gordon or something like that.
Or cartoons. They would put cartoons on sometimes, you know, depending on what they were showing.
People back then weren't really interested in
the main. That's just it. This was a phenomenon of home DVD.
I think they could have been, but it wasn't the in thing.
No, it wasn't like it wasn't commercially viable.
They had started it saying, oh, you know, this is the Abominable Snowman. This
TV
is
TV feature, the, maybe.
This is how they made it and where they made it. You know, I think people might have been interested. I don't think they could have done it with kids' films because the kids just get bored. But the sort of more adult films like this.
They even made the point here of television was in its infancy.
Yeah.
It was only just going into people's homes.
Mm.
So there wasn't that commercial availability. You know, this could have been a feature, a documentary on a TV, you know, on a TV channel, but just that had, I mean, this is the beginning. It wasn't until, that's why the 80s is a golden era. Because all this kind of stuff came into play. The idea that you basically had your own cinema in your house.
Yeah.
And then you could actually delve in and expand the lore. And it's the 80s where you got the advent of the annuals, the magazines, you know, where it wasn't just the movie, but it was all the add-ons and the toys and the fake. You know what I mean?
I had a top loader VHS player, the one where you had to sit on it to get the top down, like that. And if you didn't get it down properly, it'd come up in at you back in the chin.
I remember when I first got the double, you know, the double VCR.
Yeah,
and you really thought you were like tipping point technology. You really thought you had your own studio. You could do anything. Yeah. There was just this idea of, I can do whatever I want. This is fantastic.
Yeah, I had a hi-fi with a remote control.
The plug-in one?
Yeah.
that was a phenomenon of the 80s. Don't forget, this is way back. Like that was science fiction. The thought of that was would have been a movie.
Yeah.
Worst aspect of streaming lately is like, don't give you the option of buying renting the streaming. I honestly believe destroying cinema and destroying movie making. Streaming seemed like a good idea to me as an archival, old movies, put them on and go back to them. And then everyone wanted a piece of the pie. Everyone got greedy and stupid and they've destroyed. There's just complete apathy now towards the cinema and movies coming out. Complete apathy. People don't care. It's been ruined. The magic of it has been completely destroyed. Even the whole idea, the anticipation of waiting for a movie. Practically, if you know the right websites, you can probably appear online before it even hits the cinema. You know, that's just the way it is now. There's no even waiting because remember that stupidity of simultaneous release. So some will go into cinemas and it'll also release on a particular streaming service. HBO, I think, was the worst for that. Completely killed, you know, its movie dead. There's no anticipation of, I have to wait a year before it appears anywhere else.
Yeah, they say, see this before it goes in the cinema. And you think, well, what's the point of putting it in the cinema if you're going to show it on bloody streaming service, really? And let it go to the cinema first and then put it on your stream.
They're completely messed up. They're idiots, absolute morons. And then they're complaining that they're getting laid off. You're seeing all the journalism sites are getting closed down now and people are losing their jobs. You're seeing people, not just job and actors, having to wait tables, but you're seeing executive producers having to wait tables now because there's not enough work.
Yeah.
They did it, not us.
Yeah.
They ruined their own business model because they're stupidity, because once again, they put the wrong people in, morons who don't have a clue because they know somebody or they tick a box and not because of the actual ability or talent, and then the whole thing's crumbling. And back to what I'm saying about if there was a record of this, it'd be an absolute goldmine for anyone wanting to be an independent filmmaker, because there it was, you know, basic equipment, basic lighting, right to the basics.
Yeah.
Where you see a lot of independent film, and I always make the joke about, you see beautiful drone shot, looks amazing, crystal clear, and then it goes down to the actual act, and it's like, horrible looking.
But even an interview with the director, because people love interviews with the director and the main cast. I mean, could you imagine an interview with Peter Cushing about the film and, you know, and seeing from his point of view what he had to do as an actor, you know, and...
Yeah, oh, you mean the audio commentaries?
Yeah. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And,
but sadly, that, you know, I mean, it just wasn't available. That was something that got grown into, you know. There you go. It's interesting.
It wasn't my favorite. But from a point of view of 1957, it was okay. I'd give it 5 out of 10. I think the main feature of it was the suspense.
Probably think of how to cast the American team a bit better.
In 1957, it was a scary film, you know, and because of the suspense of it, and the suspense was done quite well. You know, perhaps I'm being too harsh by giving it 5 out of 10, possibly going up towards
6. I'd give it a 7. Honestly, for its time, and this is the first step in the major motion picture and spectacle. I think it did quite well.
Yeah.
Look how basic Quatermass Experiment and Next to the Unknown were.
Yeah.
I think the problem is, well, that because we watched The Curse of Frankenstein that came out before this, you feel like it's gone down. You know what I mean? You're not seeing a progression. You see like it was progressing and it's went down a level.
It was like a different sort of grade of film, wasn't it? You had this thing about The Curse of Frankenstein. And
I think if this had to come out, if the two had to swapped, if this had to come out in May, and The Curse of Frankenstein came out in August, I think you'd have a completely different appreciation.
Especially after watching X, the Unknown, and Quiet Mass, because they were all black and white and the same style of filming. Yeah.
And then you would see this, and then you see the taking up a notch from those two. Then you see Curse of Frankenstein. But whatever happened, we'll never know, because, like I said, there wasn't the media. There is now. While that's a good or bad thing, that's up to everyone else to decide. You know, I can see pros and cons.
Yeah.
But there you go. Still you fun. Go. Still better than a lot of shit put out today, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Still better than flipping... Capes and Curls.
Still better than anything Amazon Prime put on.
Yeah.
Oh, you see all the ratings on Amazon Prime, you know, the 3.2 out of 10, 2.8 out of 10, 1 out of 10, in the films you've never heard of. You get a good one now and again. We watched one the other day just called Exmoor, and it was actually part funded by the... Northern Ireland Film
Commission,
Commission or something, but it was actually filmed on Exmoor, and it's all initially you think it's about a group of people who are being paid to find the beast of Exmoor, which is a true, obviously, myth, you know, it becomes horror because they find this group of people who've gone to find this beast of Exmoor being hunted by a madman of some kind, it's quite a good film, actually. I was surprised. Cole didn't like it, but he don't like anything. Anything I watch, he don't like. But,
that's so funny.
If you get a chance to watch it, it's just called Exmoor.
Okay, have a look.
And it's quite a.
There's a really good one actually set in Northern Ireland called Mandrake. I covered it a while ago.
Right.
The horror movie dealing with witchcraft and actually really gritty.
Yeah.
But there you go. Fun there times. This is still a good series. I'll need to look up what we're doing next. I think we're seeing Dracula next.
Christopher Lee. Yeah,
I believe we're going to be seeing. I think it's 1957's Dracula. I think that's next.
Yeah, one of my favorites.
Yeah, there you go. So that'll be fun. It'll just be us two going, yay,
Christopher Lee. God is on. I'll go into that one in a sec because he just him being there staring with his eyes scared me left, right, center when I was a kid.
Two weeks is the 29th.
That's fine.
Another month nearly done, flip's sake.
Yeah,
time is just racing, but there you go. That'll do us for now. Thanks everyone for tuning in. And just leave to say, keep up the channel, do the type of kicky things. Until next time, keep it creepy, keep it horrific.